The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 922. It's the 13th of November 2017. On the podcast today, I have Jeremy Martin, CEO of Horizonte Minerals, HZM ticker there, and Jeremy discusses the progress at their Tier 1 nickel project in Araguaia, Brazil. Also on the podcast, it's Monday, so Malky's on. Oil and Gas Sector Authority talking about the following stocks: Rehoboth Resources, RBD, Independent Oil and Gas, IOG, Victoria Oil and Gas, VOG, Aminex, AEX, and Hurricane Energy, HUR. Plus, market analyst with Spreadex, Connor Campbell, talks about companies releasing updates this week, and they include First Group, that's FGP, Game Digital, GMD, and Royal Mail Group, RMG. I also have, as always, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Jeremy Martin, CEO of Horizonte Minerals. That's HZM ticker. Jeremy, thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Good to speak to you again.
Yeah, well, do you know what? We've been chatting now for probably a year and a half, maybe, and maybe a bit longer. And it started, you've been saying the same kind of message and, a compelling story here you've got. But you're starting to gain some traction, it seems, and that's quite nice. And of course, you've got nickel in the background, and we'll go into all this. But before we do, Jeremy, for people sort of listening right now and are still not sort of on the same page here and are not aware of what you do, give them a brief summary as to what Horizonte is all about, please.
Yeah, perfect. So Horizonte is listed on the AIM in London, listed on the main TSX exchange in Canada. We're focused in Brazil. We're developing the Araguaia nickel project, which is one of the largest, highest grade nickel saprolite projects globally. We're funded to complete a feasibility study in Q1 next year, and then we're into the construction phase of the project. So that's a broad opening of Horizonte.
And some of the figures around, for example, that came out from the pre-economic assessment here is looking very good. I mean, 28-year life of mine with a chance to extend there and throwing off a lot of free cash there. In fact, go through some of the figures if you would, Jeremy.
Yeah, so the project has got a global mineral resource of around 120 million tonnes. Within that, we converted 24 million ton reserve, which gives you a 30-year mine life. So this is actually nearly an 80 to 100-year operation. But the key is it allows you to start at one scale of production, which will be 14 to 15,000 tons of nickel a year. And then you've got the resource capacity to support an expansion to take that up to 30 or 40,000 tons of nickel a year. So it is a very large, high-grade, scalable resource. In our pre-feasibility study numbers, which I will highlight, are historic numbers from last year. On the capital cost in the study, using a $12,000 a ton nickel price, it generates around $1.3 billion of free cash flow over life of mine. So it's a massively cash generative asset.
Yeah, and it's had a lot spent on it, hasn't it? Because obviously previous owners have done a lot of work there.
Yeah, I think the history is we obviously made a grassroots discovery. In 2010 into 11, we acquired the new discovery by Teck Resources, which is Canada's largest mining company. And then last year, we were able to acquire the northern deposit from Glencore. It was essentially discovered by Falconbridge Xstrata. They had spent around $70 million on that, and we acquired that for $8 million, and of that it was $2 million up front. So it was a very good transaction for us. So yeah, the project's had a lot of previous spend, a lot of spend by us, and now, as I say, it's at the feasibility stage. So it's at the next key decision is construction.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen the share price start to move northwards, and it's probably a combination of a couple of things. That you are heading towards that major milestone, like I said, the PFS, and also like nickel is starting to get a lot of interest because of the EV market. People are starting to realise that it's an essential commodity for the electric vehicle revolution. And take us through that, if you could, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think it's been a very tough 5 years in the nickel space. The nickel space has traded at sort of 10 to 15 year historic lows. And even beginning of this year, H1, we were trading in the $7,500 to $8,500 a ton range. We've obviously been developing this story at a bottom end nickel price. And our driver has been to create a nickel project that really does work at the lowest cost point in the cycle, and that you can sit at the lowest point on the cost curve. And we've been pushing this project forwards. We've been obviously talking to the likes of you, and really now we're actually starting to see traction. We're seeing the share price increase. I mean, we're over a 50 million market cap today. And I think that's a combination of factors. One, people are actually starting to see the project de-risked. It's at feasibility stage. You've got the mining license application gone in, the construction permit's gone in. You've got a good group of cornerstone shareholders around the company: Teck, Glencore, JP Morgan, Lombard Odier, etc. So there's a solid shareholder group around it. And in parallel with that de-risking process, you've also had the nickel market increase in price as well. I mean, we've seen copper, zinc hit a 10-year high a month ago. Nickel hadn't moved up until around 3 months ago, and we've seen it move from that 7.5 to 8.5 trading range, and it's sitting at 12,300 today. So all of those factors have come into play, and then when people have gone to look for exposure to nickel, there are very few projects out there that they can get exposure to pure play nickel, and that it's the right stage of development. So I think it's all very exciting. If we actually look at the nickel market itself, today, nickel market is around 2 million tons total production. 70% of that goes into stainless steel, which is robust. That's growing at 3 to 5% a year. So the core market is driven around stainless steel, and that's a robust marketplace, and we're seeing inventory draw down and no new big projects coming into the marketplace. And then on top of that, you've had the whole electric vehicle arena focus. We've started off with lithium, then we've had cobalt, and this sort of last 6 months it's really been a focus on nickel, where people are saying, hang on, the cathode in a lot of these batteries is actually a nickel cathode, a nickel component cathode. And I think that has the potential to really change the face of the nickel business over the next 10 years. At the moment, nickel usage in EV batteries is around 1 to 2%. But if you go out over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, that could go anywhere up to 20, 30, maybe even 40%. And that new nickel has got to come from somewhere. So, sort of summarized, the stainless steel market, which is the core use of nickel today, is robust and growing. And then on top of that, you've got to go and find all of this new nickel to supply the EV market. So it's a very interesting space to be in, and there are very few big projects at the scale of ours ready to go in that time frame.
Yeah, and looking at your results, your quarterly report, yeah, you've got plenty of cash by the looks of it, just over £4 million to the end of September, so you're well financed as well.
Yeah, we've got funding in place to deliver the feasibility study, and obviously going forwards, the next stage will be the construction financing. There may be an argument to do an interim raise in that period and bring some additional institutions onto the register. But as you say, today we've got a robust cash position, net assets of 38 million. And I think, yeah, everything is slowly dropping into place, and we're de-risking this story as we go forwards.
Mm-hmm. And I like to hear every now and again, you've mentioned it before, of how much the price of nickel in the ground is compared to the last deal that was done. And just take us through that, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think it's part of the problem with nickel is it's a very small peer group. So actually trying to find comp companies is quite difficult. But we've got a couple of interesting comparisons, and the last big ferronickel project was actually in Brazil. It was about 110 kilometers northwest of us, called Onça Puma. It was developed by a Canadian junior company called Kaneco Resources. They took the feasibility took the project through to feasibility stage, completed the feasibility study. And in 2005, they were acquired by Vale for $850 million, which valued those pounds of nickel at around 25 cents per pound of nickel in the ground. And today we're trading at around two cents per pound of nickel in the ground. So still very significant value steps to go forwards. And you see this a lot with these big nickel projects. They really trade along the bottom at very low valuations until they're de-risked. And then you start to see them move up the value curve. And obviously you need the nickel price to be supportive of what as well, which it is today. So yeah, a lot of value still to go. And we're really just starting this journey today.
Yeah, well, do you know what? You know, looking at the market, like you say, stainless steel, and now on top of that, you've got the EV revolution happening. It would seem that you are a realistic target for someone, aren't you? Really?
I think that's always an interesting question. I mean, our focus is to develop this project and also create value for shareholders, whether that is developed by Horizonte, co-develop, or in the event there's a partner approaches us or an outright sale, we'll obviously look at that. And it's all a case-by-case basis. I think the reality today, nickel has really only started to move in the last 3 to 6 months. I think we need to see a sustained recovery. But already we're getting a lot more inbound traffic than we were seeing at any point in the last 2 to 3 years. And I think you've just got to look across the nickel space. Where are the big new projects? And if you're not developing them now, or you haven't been developing for them for the last 2 or 3 years, they're typically a 5 to 8 year timeline to get them into production. So yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting space for us.
Yeah, isn't it funny that when you were looking back, say, a couple of years, and the nickel price was really, you know, at the lows, and there were people sort of trying to dump projects, and now, a couple of years later, it's almost like that was the time, you know? You couldn't have timed it any better. Timing is looking perfect here, isn't it, really?
I think there's a lot of luck involved, but yeah, I think our timing is right. As a board, we made a conscious decision to advance the project during a very, very challenging nickel market, where we reached a point and nickel hit $7,000 a ton in Q4 2015, and everyone was sort of really looking at it going, where's this space going? And I think the fact we've had a very strong, supportive group of shareholders who have financed the project through these downturns, and this is cyclical play coming into its arena. And this is, you look at the deals through the last 10 to 15 years, you want to be acquiring, discovering, developing at the bottom of the market and bringing into an upswing in pricing, not doing it the other way around. So, yeah, I'm pleased where we're sitting today.
Yeah, just funny, isn't that flip of sentiment from being, you know, at a point where you're thinking, is nickel the place to be? And, you know, and now it's like one of the hot places to be. So it's very interesting. So, Jeremy, if anyone's listening right now, like the sound of this project, and they're not yet following you on Vox Markets, can you give them three reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page, please?
I think number one, this is a tier one asset, and it will go through to production. Number two, you've got a very strong group of shareholders around the company, and you can see the names from Glencore, JP Morgan, et al. And number three, going back to the valuation. I mean, if you look at what we're valued in terms of pounds of nickel in the ground today, around the 2 cents per pound, there are multiple value drivers over the short, mid and long term in terms of Horizonte. So I think it's a very exciting story. And as I said, we're only really just starting that journey today.
Marvellous, Jeremy. Good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Oil and Gas Sector Authority. It's Malky. You right, fella?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Justin, yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. It's a bit chilly, but I noticed you've grown that beard out. It's like almost coming into Father Christmas season.
And, yeah, it won't be long now to get some white dye and scare the kids.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw that picture of you with the guys from Rehobold Resources. Is that right?
Yeah, I met them last week, actually. They very kindly invited me in because I'd mentioned them a couple of times. This is very much a new kid on the block. So, yeah, in terms of what they're up to, it's quite important, because I think that they've already got a big retail following. Mm-hmm. As usual, the institutions are way behind. I think there are one or two smart hedge funds who are on the case here. So I wrote about them, and they very kindly invited me in. So, yeah, we took a picture, and I was going to mention them in my chat this morning.
Yeah, cool. Well, shall we wait for that, or shall we go with something else first?
I'll go with Rare Bull first, if you like, because obviously I met with the guys, primarily obviously to discuss the deal that they've done, the Corallian deal, which I think is looks like a very smart deal indeed, but also to discuss their policy, because now they're coming at this from a very interesting point of view. Both these guys are long-term, very experienced oil analysts. They used to work for the M&G, and they've developed a very exciting plan as to how to invest and make money for their shareholders. They've got some very good backing. People like Gervais Williams, I think, is a backer of Rearbold. I know that one or two other distinguished investors are in there. So their model is to effectively to get into assets which are almost ready to drill. Mm-hmm. So somebody else has done all the hard work, and not always just on sort of CPR and everything else. Some of it is where companies, and they could be quite big companies, majors, have looked at something, thought that it looks really interesting, but then it becomes too small. So, you know, a deal which is in the sweet spot for Rearbold at the moment would be sort of 2 to 5 million would be more interesting, because as far as I'm concerned, it looks like a really good piece of work. And I think that, you know, in terms of how I would do that, I would say, right, get, you know, 4 or 5 small acquisitions where somebody else has done all the hard work, then get somebody else in to put a bit more capital into it. And then, you know, once they've done that, they can probably end up doing, you know, another, you know, a few deals that say make the stake a little bigger, maybe 5 to 10 million. Mm-hmm. And after that, I think, you know, this company, you know, develops its own momentum. I'm really confident that, you know, that, as I say, they will find really good assets. The word has it they've got 2 or 3 on the go ready. I asked them, you know, if that was the case, and they said, well, you know, they have worked up the model on quite a number of assets. It won't necessarily come off. You know, they are buying assets from mainly from people who, as I say, done the hard work, but more importantly, you know, want a partner to come and help them finance it and take it to development. So, you know, I like the model. It looks really exciting, and I think the retail will get behind this in a big way.
Yeah, yeah, and they're guys who obviously know what they're doing here. Yeah.
Oh yeah, very, very experienced. I was most impressed, Justin.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right, what's next, Malky?
Well, I was going to talk about Independent Oil and Gas, which a sort of slightly misunderstood company in a way over the years. I think the reason for that is that, first of all, they've had fundamental and unshaking belief in the in effectively the Southern North Sea, the gas sector. Mm-hmm. Where they've got a what they call the hub at the Blyth Hub, where they added the Vulcan assets, and more recently we've been talking about Harvey. You know, don't forget they've got the Thames gas pipeline, which they bought for next to nothing, and will be able to deliver the gas from those three hubs. And they've announced in the last few days, first of all, that the CPR on Harvey added something like 114 BCF, of which 90 BCF is in their acreage. The other is in unlicensed acreage. So I would expect some short shrift applications for that. It's not really worth anybody else coming in for a small amount of gas. So I would expect some news from IOG, providing they have sort of sensible conversations with the OGA to add the rest of it. And so once you get the sort of the Harvey, you know, on Friday they announced that the expected monetary value EMV of Harvey will be about 79 million quid. Mm-hmm. They will drill, yeah, quite soon, I expect. Their commitment is something like 2018, but it might be before that. And I expect their first gas estimates of 2021 first quarter is fairly realistic. So, to be honest, Yeah, as I say, one of the reasons that the market were a bit concerned about this is over the last few years, the dream has been there, but it hasn't, people haven't been sure that it's going to be financed because of the problems with the skipper well and so on. But they've got a very strong financing group, London Oil and Gas, behind them, whom I met recently, and I'm confident that they will continue to back them. And the more you get something of a decent size, like the Blythe, Vulcan, now Harvey, hubs and gas expected within 3 or 4 years, probably 2 or 3 years if the others come on stream as we expect them to. This can be made into a reality, and given the market cap of the company is so low, I think that, that I wouldn't be surprised to see a funding for this company, because that's what they should do, get a bit more equity into there. But now the share price has risen a bit in the last few weeks. As people realise this dream is becoming a reality, I think that they'll get some following. I think they're very much one to watch, Justin.
Yeah, well, do you know what? The price gapped up on that announcement in October when the CPR confirmed a gas reserve of 303 BCF, which was previously 34 BCF. So it gapped up, but at the moment it seemed to, and it almost went to, I think it went about 33 pence then, but it came back, it finished about 25 pence, now it's down to 20 pence. So it's almost, filling that gap there. But like you said, there's only 22 million market cap. So the figures banding around there seem quite impressive, don't they, really?
Yeah, I think it's one which the market have just not worked out yet.
Yeah, cool. What's next, Malky?
Well, we had news from Victoria Oil and Gas last week. Mm-hmm. I plug away at this stock because it is probably one of the most undervalued stocks in the sector. The LA 108, Log Barber 108, came in with 84.5 metres of net pay in the upper and lower Log Barber formations. This is well in excess of what they call the pre-drill estimates, and significantly more than LA 107. So they're flow testing this well now, and expect it to come on into production by the end of this month. So things move fast on that case. But most important thing is that GDC, which is gas to Cameroon, will be able to now conclude bigger, longer-term contracts in the Douala Basin with high-usage customers, led by EEO, which is the government power generation, who are short of power. And to be honest, there are so many companies there, long-term companies, people like Guinness and a lot of the confectionery and all sorts of companies, and this economy in Douala, the second city but the largest city in Cameroon, is desperate for gas. So the demand in the area in the Douala Basin exceeds 150 million scf's a day. To give you an idea, GDC can't supply that at the moment, but they're the sole supplier, so they can't buy it from anyone else. Mm-hmm. It's worth doing the maths on this one. The company is significantly undervalued. There are people around who believe, like I do, that this has been, the hard graft has been done, and now things are looking a bit better. They've got two very exciting prospects to get more gas. One is Bomono, which is the deal they're trying to conclude at the moment, which is the former Boliven assets, which they've bought, but just waiting final approvals. And they've got the Mutanda block next door, which is even bigger, and the onshore piece of that could provide a huge amount of gas, and start to fill in, what they can't produce at the moment. So they're producing flat out, or they will be. They'll be able to get much bigger contracts to sell the gas, and as far as I'm concerned, this one looks like a no-brainer to me.
Marvellous. VOG. Anything else, Malky?
Yeah, two quick ones. Aminex, where there was a real panic. You look at the chart there last week, that they announced that they were producing less from their Kiliwani North 1 well than previously expected. It's now fluctuating below a million scf's a day. There are two or three technical reasons for this. They had a huge power cut in the area, which brought down the kit, and they think they're producing at the moment from like a small cavern as part of the bigger reservoir, and they are installing the necessary compression kit, which isn't very expensive, and I think they want to produce this at a more realistic level in order to get the longer term gas out. I know that's what people tend to say when production goes down, but I'm not too concerned about this. You know, my main reason for being a player in Amenex is for the Rovuma license, and that's got their development licenses being applied for. It's in with the government at the moment. I think this is the next stage of Amenex growing up. I think this fall was overdone, and I would like to remind people that I'm very confident about Amenex.
Yeah, so that was end of last week, was it?
Yeah. So you probably see a spike down when you look at the chart.
Yeah,
so.
Gap down, didn't it? From about 4 to 3.5. Yeah, okay, cool. All right, so Sam, but you're not worried there, you think?
I'm happy. I mean, I know it's a little blip, but it's only, you know, nothing to do with long-term part of the business, so.
Yeah, okay. And what's the last one, Mark?
Just briefly, I want to talk about Hurricane, because they made an announcement last week. Two things there. First of all, they announced that they were setting a committee to go to a premium listing, which I think is appropriate there. They've clearly been, you know, they raised $530 million, if you remember, earlier in the summer.
Yep.
Some of which, quite a lot of it, was in equity, some of it in convertible. You know, they've clearly been doing roadshows around the world where, you know, a number of people say, we would like to invest in you, but we can only invest in premium listed companies. And this is a premium company, so they deserve a premium listing. The market cap of this company is over £600 million. So I would expect, given that at 30-odd p, my target price is in excess of 100p, that I expect that's exactly the right thing to do. Now, the reason for it is stuttering at the moment is, you know, because of the warrant issue, which was a bit of a problem during the summer. But then they made the investment, and they got the $530 million, and it's just got a bit of stock indigestion as people who took that stock, are holding tight for the time being. A number of big institutions came in for the stock. Obviously, Kerrigan are there, Amber, Crystal Amber are there, and. I think it is only a question of when, because the Lancaster EPS early production system is on target. There's pictures on the website of the FPSO being converted in Dubai. They've made the big and necessary acquisitions of the big long lead items in terms of kit and so on. As we go through the year end, we'll suddenly realise that first oil from this one is 2019, first half. Providing that sticks, then suddenly becomes very, very critical. And I think that'll be, you know, highly important for Hurricane. And I think as you look at Hurricane and you say, right, you know, where is the big next tick up going to be? Apart from, obviously, we've had all the important things like the FID. We've got CPR coming shortly, I expect, from the whole company, and we've got people saying, when is the data room going to be open, or when they expect to farm out? Well, the data room is open, but I think, you know, for example, BP announced said at a conference in Aberdeen a couple of months ago that they're looking at it very carefully, and although they like the look of it, and if it works, I'm sure there'll be a buyer along with everybody else. And most people are just waiting because this fractured basement technology, which Robert Trice has developed, is fairly new to this part of the world. It's not new in other parts of the world, but they want to see it actually producing the oil and not having water ingress or production falling off very quickly or whatever. And if and when that happens, then this is a company, in my view, with nearer 2 billion barrels of oil than one, and therefore, if that's the case, then it should be nearer, well over £1 billion pounds market cap. So, that's that. And the chairman resigned in a huff on the other day, with immediate effect, as they say. And I think this is a perfect opportunity to get a high-quality chairman for a high-quality company, someone with bigger company experience, somebody who can work with the team at Hurricane. And so the fact that the chairman disappeared is just not a bad thing, to be honest, Justin.
Yeah. So, I mean, I got to look at the headline here. So, he criticised them for governance, didn't he? But
yeah, I saw that in the FT. He wrote a letter to the FT when he resigned. Did he fall or was he pushed? Is the most important question. But yeah, I mean, it was a bit bitter and twisted. And I think that that's behind them now. I think he tried to accuse them of not having enough corporate governance. But I know this very well, and you don't raise £530 million with some of the best institutions in the country and internationally if you've got bad corporate governance. You know, these companies who invest in something like Hurricane look very carefully at companies before they invest in them. Mm-hmm. So I suspect a very large number of sour grapes are being passed here, and I think that the new chairman will bode very well for the future for Hurricane.
Yeah, so, but like I say, the share price at the moment is just, bumping along there at 30 pence-ish. But you reckon, sort of, if anything's going to sort of move a little bit, then what, the CPR is the next milestone, is it, you reckon, or what?
Yeah, CPR is the next milestone. And then over the next few months, we'll get announcements that, you know, sort of big bits of kit have been during that. As soon as the good weather comes next spring, they'll be bringing stuff onto site. The FPSO will be completed in Dubai before long, and we'll see that moving onto site in the West of Shetlands as well. Mm-hmm. And cool. I think that the CPR, as I say, will be important. And as I say, once we get after Christmas, it'll be beginning to be only a year or so before we get first oil.
Yeah, excellent
stuff. All the majors, I mean, there are plenty of big companies in that data room at the moment looking at it. And as I say, BP have said they're going to wait to see whether it works or not. It's quite possible that one of them or two of them might break ranks, because they will probably think it's going to become much more expensive when people realise it really does work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, if anything, the board at Hurricane may be sort of looking at an offer and saying, should we take it because we might be able to get more later? But that's a nice problem to have.
Exactly, Well, and for the big companies, that's a risk you have to take. Like you said, if you want to, you're going to have deep pockets or deeper pockets later on, or you take a bit more risk now and get a bit more upside. It's up to them, isn't it?
But it's exactly right, Justin, exactly right.
Yeah, marvellous stuff, Malky. Have a nice week, and we'll speak next week, fella.
Yeah, look forward to it, Justin. Thanks very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is market analyst with Spreadex. It's Connor Campbell. You all right, Connor?
Very good, thank you.
Now, looking at the week ahead, some of the bigger companies reporting. So what are we going with first?
First group reports on Tuesday. It's the half-year figures on Tuesday. It's had quite the proverbial tale of two halves, really, for First Group. Mm-hmm. I think by the end of May, it surged to four-year highs. It saw a really, really sharp rise first five-ish months of the year. And since then, it's almost been a mirror. Basically, it's just plunged. I think at the end of October, it was in trading at eight-month lows. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, so, you know, sifting through the last few updates and things, I've been struggling to find exactly what went wrong, really. Like, it's in February, part of the reason it rose so sharply, third quarter figures were up 12.8%, largely due to the benefit of currency movements, because First Group owns, runs the first rail and things like that over here. But in America, it has Greyhound buses. So, obviously, it's got that division, so it benefits from the currency movements. In March, it won the contract to operate the Southwest Trains franchise as part of like a consortium including Hong Kong's MTR. But then it sort of all went wrong at the start of June when it released its full year figures. But pre-tax profit was up 23% to $207 million. Revenue was up 8.3% to $5.65 billion. You know, those are pretty robust figures. But it seems that it sort of warned on its first half margins for the first rail business in the UK, and was cautious about the division's rate of passenger growth in the first half of the then upcoming year. And then it seems like just investors were disappointed that it didn't restore its dividend. I don't think it's had a dividend since 2013. There was some expectation that, you know, you look at the strength of those figures, there was some expectation that they would potentially restore that in June, and they didn't. And that seems to have dragged it lower at the start of June. And then I think, as we were talking before, June was sort of an ugly month for any company that requires people to spend money on it did poorly in June, basically. And, you know, it was no different for First Group. And since then, it sort of continued to fall. Like, I think, given those figures, it's quite a drastic drop compared to sort of the health of the figures it put out there. I think if, you know, it's half year figures on Tuesday, if it can post the same kind of revenue and pre-tax profit growth as it did back in June, then there is room for it to sort of bounce back a bit, because it's fallen astonishingly sharply over summer, basically, and the start of autumn. And so we've seen, it's a bit mixed around the £1 mark, but we have largely been seeing our clients buy around that £1 mark, I think, just looking for some kind of bounce on Tuesday.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? They also, on the Greyhound, of course, is an iconic brand in America. You've seen all films, don't you? But also they own First Student, which I'm just reading about, which is the largest provider of student transportation, with a fleet of around 44,000 yellow school buses, which are, of course, are also iconic in America. Very interesting. But there we are. Yeah, the share price is looking flat. Like I said, it's dropped off and just it's bumping slowly lower. And what happened in, it's almost like between, you know, what was it, June or February this year, up until the summer, it went from like, you know, where it is, £1 up to 150, and it just fell off a cliff then, didn't it? Just come back down, because it went up, then down. It's like a bus going up a hill there, sort of, went down, come down fast, and then went up. But there we go. That's First Group, so they're reporting. Who else, Connor, are you looking at?
We've got Game Digital on Wednesday. I was sort of, you know, as I was looking for the stocks to talk about this week, I was surprised to see how much interest there was around Game Digital from our clients, like buying around the, I think it's just below 40p at the moment. Because it had, for much of the year, had a very, very bad 6 or 7 or 8 months. It eventually hit all-time lows of 18.6p in I think July, and that's compared to at that point of the year previous it was trading at £1. I think when it sort of had its, you know, relaunch a few years before, its IPO was around, or its first day of trading was around £2.
Yeah.
So it's really, 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 you know, suffered. Makes sense, you know, it's one of those companies in the direct firing line of Amazon, basically. It's the kind of company that it makes sense that it would sort of get wiped out by Amazon. Plus more and more games companies, you know, encourage people to download the games instead of buying them physically, so that sort of removes game from that transaction.
I was going to say, these are like, it's almost like they are a newer version of Blockbuster Video, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas people don't have, our kids have DVDs because they're quite hardy things, but we also download stuff from Sky, and so it's getting to the stage now where people don't go out and hire these kind of things or buy them, but they just download them and they're online on the cloud, aren't they, you know?
But there's a few interesting kinks to sort of Game Digital's story this year, really. Like, as you can see on the chart, that they had some really nasty drops. I think, pre-tax profit back in March had fallen 26.7%, but that wasn't really where the stock fell. It was in June. It was a profit warning in June when it said earnings would be substantially below previous expectations, mainly due to sort of a poor lineup of games releases this year impacting sales of both games and then Xbox and PlayStation consoles, as well as insufficient supply of the Nintendo Switch, which has been a huge success in 2017, the launch of the Nintendo Switch. But, you know, if you haven't got enough stock to sell it, then it doesn't matter how much demand there is. That you know, I think it fell like 37% on the day of that, of the that profit warning. That was when it hit the, you know, 18.6p.
Yeah.
Since then, however, Mike Ashley, I think maybe 2 weeks later, the vulture that he is, bought 25% stake in the stock. That helped it out a bit in July. Then in August, it was far more positive than it had been before. It said in the second half of the year, UK sales had jumped 9%. And they were still down 7% for the year in total, which sort of shows how badly the first half went. But, you know, that's still signs of progress. In Spain, they're up 26%, which actually helped Game eke out a 0.1% rise in annual retail sales year on year, which isn't bad given just how poorly it was doing in the first half of the year. Interestingly, I think this is also why it rose quite sharply off of this update in August. It announced it'd be focusing more of its attention on the sort of the esports arena, which is a really rapidly growing market. I think currently, I think I read that despite, you know, how poor the game is doing, it's the highest valued esports company that's publicly traded, which shows that, you know, it is well positioned to sort of grab a chunk of that market. And I think that market's maybe worth, it's approaching $1 billion or pounds, I'm not quite sure. But, you know, it's the kind of market that is only going to grow in the next few years. So if Game can get in on roughly the ground floor, then that could be an interesting pivot for the company going forward. Yeah, in terms of its full year figures on Wednesday, I really think the reaction is going to be dependent on, you know, just how below previous expectations are those for your earnings going to be, basically. I think also, you know, we're heading into Christmas. Investors are going to want to know what's the outlook for Christmas. Have they got enough Nintendo Switches to fulfill demand heading into that festive period? It's also said that next year there's a far better lineup of video games coming out, and there is, like, as someone that plays video games, next year there is a lot of big releases. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of outlook they send out for next year as well, given that things should pick up in terms of the product that's on offer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but do you know what? I've always been, you know, when I've read updates on this company, it's almost as if it won't be a good year for them because there aren't many game releases. I thought, if you're a slave to that industry, aren't they, really? And if there aren't decent game releases, they're in trouble. And I thought, I don't want to invest in a company that is reliant on the steady flow of games, you know?
Games take a while to make, so it becomes a bit cyclical. Like, you obviously have games like FIFA and Call of Duty and that, where there's one every year. They're like yearly installments, but that isn't enough, really. You do get years where sort of the game slate is a bit thin on the ground, just because, you know, these things move in like 2 or 3 year cycles, and then you get a bumper year next year where there's 3 or 4 mega games coming out that, you know, should bump up the figures. But like you said, it's sort of risky, but at its current lows, there perhaps is room for a short-term bounce, and I think that's what our clients are looking at.
Yeah, exactly. Anything else, Connor?
Yeah, finally, we've got Royal Mail on Thursday. Again, another company that's had pretty poor year. It's looking a bit battered. I think it hit all-time lows in the end of October.
Do you know what? This is very much why it came on my radar. I only look for stocks that have been beaten down pretty much. I'm not a momentum chaser, because I think if you've got a big company and they've got, you know, reserves and they're having issues, they've got the money to sort it out. You know, it may take a while to turn it round, but essentially the share price will stop dropping. It'll bottom out for a little bit. And I've been looking at Royal Mail for a while, and they've still got issues. And I've stopped reading the updates, but I mean, they're going through issues with in High Court, aren't they, and all this stuff. And so about, I think, pensions and all this stuff and working hours. And so at the moment, it is all-time lows. But it's one of those things that when they clear that, when they see some headway there and they get beyond that, it will bounce, you know, and it's just almost, and it'll re-rate. But at the moment, they're still mired in that problem. So anyway, what's happening there, fella?
Yeah, well, the main issue, as it has been for the last few years, and I imagine as it will be for the next few years, is letters revenues. That, you know, that makes up half of the company's revenue. And they're just consistently falling. They're consistently falling around 5 or 6%. Letter volumes are dropping around 5 or 6%. It's, you know, it was seen as good news in July that letter revenues only fell by 4% because of an increase in mailings around the general election in the UK. There are a few positives. GLS, which is it's like a Dutch firm. It's basically Royal Mail's international delivery arm. That has been consistently strong in the last few quarters. That's the main thing that's helped. Anytime Royal Mail has eked out a 1% rise in group revenue, it's largely down to growth of volumes and growth of revenue at GLS. Its parcels division is also doing quite well. I think that's sort of sees consistent 3% growth in revenue. Mm-hmm. And around 2% growth in volume. But again, I think that is meant to get up to around half of the total revenue for the company, which is a good sign that the thing that is still making money is becoming a bigger part of the company. However, again, it's sort of it's a division that's a bit under threat by Amazon. You know, there is the argument that the more people shop online, you know, that increases parcel delivery, so that helps out Royal Mail. But at the same time, the more people buy online, more often than not, they're buying from Amazon.
Yeah.
Doesn't use Royal Mail. So it's sort of, you know, it's a bit give and take in that area, really. Yeah. Obviously, we're heading into Christmas. Any outlook on Christmas will be welcomed by investors. Ideally, it needs to find a way to sort of slow the decline further in the letters of revenues, but I genuinely don't know how they can, really. Mm. It's also warned that sort of Brexit uncertainty is impacting the amount of junk mail it delivers, because companies are a bit more reticent to send out advertising and business letters and things like that, which obviously good news for most people, but isn't particularly great for Royal Mail itself. Credit Suisse, again, when it fell to those all-time lows in October, it was largely down to an incredibly bearish note from Credit Suisse. I think they cut their price target from £4.92 to £3.25, because it basically said that it doesn't think its earnings are sustainable given the worsening drop in the letters revenue, with things like over 65s becoming more used to using the internet, so that reduces, you know, they're one of the last groups, I guess, that send letters, and that's only going to, you know, decrease in the coming years when people just you know, by a certain point, people are just going to use email. And stuff like the government and certain banks are trying to cut down on the amount of letters they send out. Obviously, you know, most banks now offer a paperless service. You know, you can opt out of getting your statements and that sent to them. So it's just, you know, it's progress. It's you know, internet progress. It's environmental progress. It's sort of whatever Royal Mail manages. It's sort of, it has that stink of failure, like that tinge of you know, this might be going okay, but what it was known for is just under threat. It's like a dying species of business.
Yeah, it may have to settle at a lot lower level, and then you know, and then when it's just obviously still generating profit there, but when it's still generating profit,
it's full year revenue is still £9.8 billion. Pre-tax profit jumped by 25% at the full year. It's still, you know, posting some healthy figures, but at the moment, each release sort of has a dampener put on it by the letters revenues thing. Yeah. So until the switch takes over, that parcels is the bigger side of things, and that parcels begins to, you know, become 60% of the business, 70% of the business. And like you said, it might settle at a lower price, but once it does that, then there is room for it to bounce back a bit. And I think that's why we've seen clients buying at the 370 mark, because it's fallen so low that there is still room for, you know, if it has a decent enough Christmas, the other side of the new year, then maybe there is room for a bit of a bounce in January or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm just looking there. It's not overly priced, it's not expensive, you know, operating. Pre-tax profit, or profit, so £559 million was their last profit before tax. So, and their market cap is £3.7 billion. So, you know, their PE of less than 10 is pretty much. So, it's not expensive, you know. It's just at the moment they're going through all these issues, I suppose. Anyway, they should get a boost as well from Santa, of course, receiving lots of letters. My kids are yet to send theirs off. Having said that, that's free mail as well. I think Santa pays for that. Anyway, Connor, thanks for that, fella. Have a nice week. We'll speak next week, fella.
You talk next week.
All right, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They were at five, Prospects Oil and Gas, BXOG. At four, Jan Garden Mines. Ticker there is Jan. All right, Jan. That's a name of a certain generation, isn't it? I talked about Jan Garden Mines, actually, on the Weekend Podcast. I've written a blog about them. And I think the economics around that project they have there, a PGM mine in Brazil, are compelling. An IRR of 80%, internal rate of return, is phenomenal. But check it out. Have a listen to the Weekend Podcast and read my blog there if you want to. And I think just go to Vox there and search for Jan. It's under their timeline there somewhere. But do your own research. But it's shaping up to be a very impressive project. And the pre-feasibility study is out before the end of the year. Okay. At three, most followed, Cogent Power, CGP. At two, Main Energy, MYN. And number one, most followed company on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, it's quite a big rise today, at 14%, it's Hemogenix, H-E-M-O. All right, top five most liked analysts are from the following companies. At four, Horizonte Minerals, I talked to Jeremy earlier, H&M, quarterly report. At four, Highlands Natural Resources, That's H&R. Preliminary results from Wild Horse and Powell Wells. That's three. Prospect Oil and Gas, PXOG. That's a commencement of drilling onshore Romania. At two, STX Energy. That's STX ticket, of course. Gas discovery at KSR 15 Well, Morocco. And number one, most liked RNS, was a mid-morning release from Asia Met Resources. And that's Asia Met extends high-grade copper mineralization beneath BKZ, zinc, lead, copper, silver, and gold deposit. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. I got to say, Asia Met is flying. Absolutely flying. People are paying over 10 pence for the share this morning. And they keep releasing sort of amazing grades from that. So they are swimming in mineralization there. Anyway, that's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Financial Times guides you through complex issues. In divisive times, don't settle for black and white. When you need the full perspective, turn to FT.com. Become a subscriber today. Search for FT subscription.